Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And my two 12-year-olds are going to bed early this week and next to make sure they get a good night's sleep as they deal with their 7th grade Common Core standardized tests. Sometime next week, they will get back to 7th grade as usual when the sleep disruptive stress of those tests will end. Later this hour, we'll tell you about a project for finding out just what kind of a sleeper you are. The details your spouse knows but perhaps won't tell you, whether your 7th graders are sleeping well or not, illuminating the vast mystery of sleep for all of you solo sleepers out there without waking you up. It's called the Clock Your Sleep Project. Later this hour, it just might be a wake-up call to more productive slumber and better health. We'll also explore the mid-20th century ghosts that still haunt Europe, a look at the perilous history of those parts of Europe that lie between Germany and Russia. Some TV greats get tested as we settle on the final four in our TV bracket competition. But we begin with those tests that my 12-year-olds are right in the middle of. The Common Core Educational Standards, Curriculum and Approach to Education will culminate between now and the beginning of June with a battery of tests. Being used in nearly every state, it's a final trial run for the standardized testing program that will be used in earnest beginning next year. Used for what, Carmel Martin?
They're going to be used to assess how our students are doing against the standards and skills that are needed for them to be successful at the college level, but also in career and life. The standards were developed by teachers, experts, state and local leaders who had a lot of evidence that our current state standards weren't preparing our children for what they needed to be successful as they moved on to college and into the workforce.
Carmel Martin is Executive Vice President for Policy at the Center for American Progress and former Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development. A little different voice now from Liz Rosenberg. Not so much enthusiasm in your household for these Common Core tests. Liz, explain.
Actually, my daughter would have loved to have taken the test, but we decided that she would not take it because having seen some of the tests, the sample tests online, and talking to teachers and hearing from our principal, feeling like this test is not serving our school and it's not serving other schools. As an educator, I'm not just a parent. I've been in numerous schools where there's an incredible focus on the test, and now that the test is tied to teacher evaluations, it's very hard for teachers not to do even more test prep because their jobs are on the line.
What's the conversation like among other parents like yourself who are opting out in these Common Core tests?
I happen to be a fourth grade parent, and fourth grade in District 15, where my daughter goes to school, is the year that counts when you're going to go to middle school. So the middle school test is looked at as part of admission to middle school, which is kind of crazy when you think about college admission, but this is just middle school admission. So for fourth grade parents, it was a really hard decision in general. We wanted to know from the schools whether or not they would accept our children without the test scores. And so some parents went to work and called, I think, 19 schools, maybe less, in District 15 and found that those schools would be willing to look at our children in a more holistic way.
All right. To Carmel Martin, what do you make of the parental opt-out options here in New York, as Liz Rosenberg is describing, and around the country?
So, as a parent myself, I understand that some parents might decide that opting out is the right thing to do, but I guess I would argue that as parents we shouldn't opt out because these assessments really are designed to tell parents but also teachers and the students themselves how they're doing. And they're really, it's like in the medical profession, you use a thermometer or an x-ray machine to see how things are going. That said, I think there's legitimate concerns about the way tests are being used and the overemphasis on tests in our education system. I think the ironic part here is these new tests are an effort to try to get beyond those prior poor practices. These assessments are designed to be a richer analysis of how kids are doing and not the traditional fill-in-the-bubble multiple choice test. So I hope parents and educators will give these assessments a chance because I do think they'll be better than the assessments we've used in the past.
All right, Carmel Martin, what do you make of whole states opting out, though? Indiana has decided to jettison the Common Core for now. How does that affect the national picture?
So they're in the process of developing new standards. So it's not that they're rejecting the idea of standards and assessments to measure how we're doing against those standards. I mean, tests really are a critical part of the education endeavor. So I hope the debate, and I don't think the debate in Indiana, but I hope the debate isn't whether we use tests at all, but rather what are the best tests we can use to assess how our students are doing, and more importantly, how do we use them productively and not counterproductively? There's been legitimate concerns about an overemphasis on tests, teaching to the test, narrowing curriculum to meet tests. These new tests where we're really just in a beta phase around them to make sure they are as rich and productive as we want them to be. But these new tests are designed to try to tackle some of those problems, as are the standards. I mean, in the prior generation of tests, it was very much memorize information and test whether you know the content. The new standards are really focused as much on skills as on content, which I think is really important when you think about what you want your children to be able to do, not just as a future worker in our economy, but as a member of our society. You want them to have problem-solving skills, critical thinking skills, good communication skills. That's really at the core of these new standards. And the new tests are designed to assess whether children have those skills. So it's not just do they know information, but are they able to apply the information? Because that's going to make them more capable to tackle college content, but as importantly, more capable to tackle life.
That's Carmel Martin, who's Executive Vice President for Policy at the Center for American Progress, former Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development at the U.S. Department of Education. Carmel, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Brooklyn mom Liz Rosenberg. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Big story out of Washington, D.C., and another test of this nation's campaign finance laws. Majority of the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court says that restrictions on certain kinds of campaign contributions fail to meet the constitutional tests for freedom of speech, and so those limits were struck down. It was the by now very familiar 5-4 split, with Chief Justice John Roberts writing the majority opinion and Justice Stephen Breyer writing the dissent. Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University and president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, joins us now. Professor, welcome back.
Great to be here.
So this is all about aggregate limits on how many people you can contribute to. Describe the specific argument regarding these aggregate limits.
That's exactly right. The question is how much people can cumulatively contribute to all candidates for federal offices and party committees. The limits had stood at 48,600 per candidate committees, 74,000 and change for contributions to party committees, a total of 123,000. Basically, these have been in place since 1974. They were upheld by the Supreme Court in its seminal decision, Buckley versus Valeo, in 1976. But the 5-4 majority you described struck down these aggregate limits today on the grounds that they don't further the only government interest the court accepted as legitimate in Buckley, according to Chief Justice Roberts, and that was namely quid pro quo corruption. And the nub of this case is that the majority defined corruption very narrowly, basically, money for votes. And the dissenters, led by Justice Stephen Breyer in a fiery and passionate dissent, which he read from the bench, said that the court had changed the definition of corruption and effectively overruled Buckley. Breyer said that ever since Buckley, the court had recognized broader kinds of corruption, the idea that candidates would be more responsive to big donors, even if they weren't directly being paid for votes. And by narrowing the definition of corruption, Breyer said, the court had really fundamentally transformed campaign finance law and made any kind of regulation much more difficult.
Although there's a line in the Roberts majority opinion that's hard to argue with here, and that is that the law can no more restrict the number of contributor candidates a contributor can give money to then it could restrict a newspaper from endorsing candidates. That's a pretty interesting argument there. The idea, it's not so much the individual contribution limits that are at issue here. It's the idea that you are limited to the number of candidates you can actually contribute to.
It's a very interesting idea, and that's why this is such a fascinating case, because there are strong First Amendment arguments against these aggregate limits, and they're supported not only by libertarian conservatives, but by some civil libertarian liberals who care about the First Amendment. But Justice Breyer said there are also strong First Amendment interests on the other side, that the First Amendment requires a democracy where a few rich individuals can't drown out everyone else. And he was being much more pragmatic. He has a very powerful part of his opinion where he gave examples of ways that huge amounts of money could be contributed. Example one, gifts for the benefit of the party. He said that an individual could give $1.2 million over 2 years to the party. But then he said for donations to individual candidates, the $3.6 million check, you can pretend to be giving to individual committees, but in fact, that money can be funneled back to one single candidate. So the pragmatist Breyer against the more formalist Roberts have just two very different views of what the First Amendment requires.
Although Justice Roberts did raise the possibility that Congress would regulate the transfers of money, as you have talked about there. Going to the Breyer opinion here, it seems to me that Justice Breyer is also alluding to the possibility that these limits being struck down will allow, make it easier, actually, for wealthy people to flood the zone in the last moments of a campaign, and that's a form of corruption that he says the majority doesn't recognize.
Very much. Breyer cares very deeply about this issue as a pragmatist and someone who's written a book about active liberty and how democracy requires participation. He went back to the founding and said the founders had a broader vision of corruption than Chief Justice Roberts did in insisting that individual citizens could find their representatives to be responsive to them. And Breyer said that when a handful of wealthy individuals can flood the market with these huge checks, that is the kind of corruption bringing stopping that citizen responsiveness that the founders wanted to prevent. He quoted Rousseau as well as James Wilson. And Breyer also, as a pragmatist, was impatient with the majority suggestion, well, Congress could just tighten up the transfer limits. He said these limits have been in place for a long time. Congress hasn't been able to tighten them further. And he was most upset. He said the majority is just speculating that these transfer limits are going to work. We don't have a record before us. Usually we would have sent it back to a lower court to find out whether the transfer limits are working. This is purely hypothetical. Now, the Chief Justice Roberts counters, well, Breyer, your vision of the $3.6 million check is also hypothetical, and I don't think the limits are going to work that way. It was both sides were talking past each other, both about philosophically what the First Amendment requires and also practically what the effect of this decision was actually going
to
be.
You referred to the Buckley versus Viejo decision that established the sort of logic of campaign limits. I counted a number of references to Buckley in the Roberts majority opinion. It seems that he keeps saying that the base limits, the idea that an individual limit, that the government has an interest in maintaining those limits. He's not disturbing that logic, it seems to me. Are you buying it, or do you see a slippery slope here?
Breyer does not buy it. You're absolutely right that Roberts and his three colleagues, Scalia, Alito, and Kennedy, formally say they're not overturning Buckley. But rather Breyer says by changing the definition of corruption, you are, in effect, overruling that part of Buckley, which upheld the aggregate limits similar to the ones at issue here. Justice Clarence Thomas filed a separate concurring opinion openly saying, okay, guys, I would just come out and overturn Buckley. And the other conservative justices pointedly did not join him in that. But the dissent once again says that Scalia had once accused Chief Justice Roberts of faux judicial restraint by claiming to be incrementalist, but in effect, overturning a decision. And that's what Breyer is suggesting that he's doing here.
Where are we headed in campaign finance law in the middle of an election year? Jeffrey Rosen is professor of law at George Washington University and president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Thanks as always.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Is the highest principle in business making the most money? That is the impression, according to a surprising story in Mother Jones magazine about the company Hobby Lobby. You'll recall that Hobby Lobby, a craft store chain, argued last week before the U.S. Supreme Court that its religious principles would be violated if it was compelled to offer health care plans under Obamacare that covered contraceptives, including the so-called morning after pill, the emergency contraceptive drug. The Mother Jones story shows that Hobby Lobby's 401k retirement plan for employees holds more than $73 million in mutual funds in companies that produce emergency contraceptive pills, intrauterine devices, and drugs used in abortions, according to documents filed with the Department of Labor. Molly Redden is a staff reporter for Mother Jones, and she broke the story. Molly, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So what have you found in the sort of investment portfolio of Hobby Lobby that would seem to argue against their statement of principles before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, we took a look at some of the holdings in the mutual funds contained in their employee savings plans. And what we found is that in several of them, there are holdings in companies like Pfizer and Teva Pharmaceuticals and other companies that manufacture not only the emergency contraceptives that they would like to remove from their employee health care plans, but some drugs that are used to cause abortions. And we thought this was important to bring to the political conversation because to Hobby Lobby, the idea that their employee health care plans might someday be used for one of their female employees to take emergency contraceptives was so offensive to them that they argued all the way up to the Supreme Court. So we just thought it was interesting that in their investment portfolios, sort of, you know, the same indirect support for some of these companies was there.
What is the likelihood that the folks at Hobby Lobby, you know, just were unaware of this sort of thing, or that their lack of vigilance about their 401k retirement plans does not contradict the arguments that they made before the Supreme Court, even though on paper it seems to contradict?
Well, it's not clear to us to what extent they knew. We reached out to Hobby Lobby last week with a pretty detailed summary of some of our findings, and they never got back to us on whether they've changed their policies since these papers were filed in 2012. Now, that was after they first sued the government, but they haven't told us whether they've changed their plans. Now, if they wanted to divest from some of these institutions, they could do so. There's sort of a cottage industry of mutual funds out there, the Timothy Plan, the Ave Maria Fund, run by religiously minded individuals that have screened mutual funds for companies that religious business owners might find objectionable.
So your argument there would be if Hobby Lobby was really serious about keeping its retirement and investment portfolio free of what it views as ideologically impure businesses, it certainly had the option of doing that. There were clear avenues for doing that.
That's right. It could do so. And, you know, again, we don't know if this is just something that never occurred to them. But in their business, a lot of ways to avoid entanglements with companies that they sort of disagree with morally have occurred to them. They don't sell shot glasses, for example. They're closed on Sundays. They don't fill the extra space in their trucks with beer, what's calling backhauling beer, to help liquor distributors and beer distributors get their product to far-flung gas stations for some extra money.
So is this an aha in your view? Is it inconsistent? Does it say, at least in theory, that you know, one cannot, make a religious case in business because this sort of thing takes place in church, not in the investment portfolios?
Well, we do find it inconsistent. You know, I don't think this has a lot of bearing on Hobby Lobby's legal argument because neither Hobby Lobby nor the government asked the Supreme Court to consider the sincerity of their religious beliefs. But we do think it's important to mention for the political conversation. An ordinary person probably wouldn't mind if some very small portion of their employee savings plan was vested with a company whose business they didn't agree with. But Hobby Lobby isn't an ordinary company. When they disagreed with a very small provision of their employee health care plan under Obamacare, they took it to the Supreme Court.
So would you say that based on your view of Hobby Lobby in its entirety, financially in its entirety, that making money is a higher value than sort of religious values regarding contraception?
Well, I don't know if we could conclusively say that based on what we found in their mutual funds. And I also want to note that the difference between sort of a religiously minded set of mutual funds and a more traditional one, the return on your investment doesn't seem to be that large. I think the point of exposing this was to sort of say that when you're a business owner and you're involved in our markets in lots of complicated ways, inevitably you have ties with businesses whose operations you might not agree with. And the ability to insulate yourself from that is not infinite.
So perhaps the takeaway here is not so much an issue of principle, but a question of execution, that if the government is going to start enforcing and the courts are going to start enforcing religious principles in every aspect of business for companies that want to preserve some principle, as a matter of practice, it's almost impossible. That's what this story shows.
That's right. And for a business to sort of selectively pick out items of its operation and demand the ability to run those according to the personal moral beliefs of some of their owners can be very hypocritical.
Molly Redden is a staff reporter for Mother Jones. Thanks so much, Molly.
Thank you.
Want to clock your sleep? Ever wonder why you wake up tired or rested? What goes on while you're nodded out? You can get some questions answered by going to WNYC.org/sleep to learn how to check your sleep time, log your information in when you wake up and go to bed, and see how you compare with your neighbors.
Hi, this is Pam. I'm calling from Richardson, Texas. I have a 2-year-old daughter who has never been a big fan of sleep and still isn't. So that means mommy doesn't get much sleep either.
How about Seattle, Washington? Lack of sleep runs in my family. My dad was documented not sleeping for 30 years. He's in medical journals. And what keeps you up in Winter Park, Florida? Facebook, because I lack discipline. Tell us what's holding your slumber back, how many winks short of 40 you are at 8778-MY-TAKE, or leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
If you've been following our TV bracket tournament to go along with the NCAA tournament, you know that Data is Butler from nowhere. Just like one of those small Cinderella schools like George Mason, Data from Star Trek The Next Generation eliminated Tony Soprano. So nerdy little Data is in the Final Four with top seed and big winner Archie Bunker and Lucy of I Love Lucy and Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show. In today's face-offs, a famous scene that makes the case for each character, beginning with Data.
The scene that best shows the essence of Data is from Season 3, Episode 16, called The Offspring. In this scene, Data is talking to the android daughter he created about why he continually struggles to be more human.
Why do you still try to emulate humans? What purpose does it serve except to remind you that you are incomplete?
I have asked myself that many times, as I have struggled to be more human. Until I realized it is the struggle itself that is most important. We must strive to be more than we are, Lal. It does not matter that we will never reach our ultimate goal. The effort yields its own rewards.
You are wise, Father.
It is the difference between knowledge and experience.
At the end of the scene, Data holds his daughter's hand. Even though he doesn't know why, he just knows that what's happening between them is special. Data reminds us that our best moments aren't our huge triumphs or conquests. It's those little moments of humanity that make us all who we are. So voters, engage and vote for Data, the Takeaway Cinderella story, as the best TV character of all time.
Yes.
It's been more than 30 years since Archie Bunker went off the air, but he's still thoroughly modern. Way back in 1976, the old flag-waving patriot met his mortal enemy, a draft dodger.
My own father doesn't understand. Why should he?
When the hell are you going to admit that the war was wrong?
I ain't talking about that war. I don't want to talk about that rotten damn war no more. I'm talking about something else. And what he done was wrong. Well, you think the whole people of this country can say whether or not they want to go to war? You couldn't get a decent war off the ground that way. All the young people would say no, sure they would, because they don't want to get killed. And that's why we leave it to the Congress, because them old cracks ain't going to get killed. And they're going to do the right thing and get behind the president and vote yes.
Archie sounds kind of confused there. Is he for the war or against it? Does he remind you of any conversations you had during the last 10 years of wartime? Does he remind you of, perhaps, yourself? Vote for Archie Bunker as the greatest television character of all time at thetakeaway.org.
Data versus Bunker, presented by Takeaway Administrative Assistant Jolenta Greenberg and Senior Producer Irva Gunja. But it's up to you to vote. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to cast your vote. And if you're still disappointed that your favorite characters haven't made our brackets, you can nominate a wild card third contestant to be added on Friday based on your spirited defenses. Thetakeaway.org is where you can vote, rant, and nominate your wild card candidate. We'll hear from the other two characters left in our final four later this hour, Mary Richards and Lucy from I Love Lucy. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Who is paying particular attention to what is going on in Europe right now? We begin a series of conversations with people from Central and Eastern Europe whose homelands lie between Russia and Germany, and where the footprints of history still feel fresh and the bloody ghosts of the 20th century are easily stirred. When Vladimir Putin talks about territorial rights and protecting Russians in Crimea and Ukraine and Moldova, these people hear memories of invasions and violence. Our first voice comes from the Czech Republic, formerly Czechoslovakia, where the Soviets invaded in August of 1968. Prague native Michael Level says the Ukraine crisis has brought the year 1968 back for him in vivid color.
I was 17 when Russians came. And at that time, you know, by 17, we didn't travel abroad, so we didn't have too much of idea how it is in the West. And then it started to tour a little bit in 1968. Well, we were listening more of the West radio, and some books were coming in. So we learned a little bit what's happening, and we were curious. But then, you know, for another 23 years, it was basically stamped out. You couldn't travel, you couldn't read whatever you wanted. You were really limited in what you could do.
When you look at the people of Ukraine who profess, anyway, to feel a warm embrace of the West, or some sense that they really yearn for the kind of freedoms that you're talking about right there, do you believe, based on your experience, that those yearnings and the taste of being closer to the West can be simply shut off by the actions of a nation like Russia?
I don't think so. Because, you know, we tasted it back here for half a year, maybe a year in 1968. But they, in Ukraine, they tasted it for, almost 20 years. So they know the connection to the West is pretty real. And by the way, now there is internet, there is radio, there is TV. So you know what is happening. You cannot be completely cut off the information like back there in the 60s. So, yeah, it's very real.
And as far as the possibility that this could become a wider conflict, what do you think about that? Certainly historians are talking about, you know, this is a conflict that could, you know, raise the ghosts of World War I even. But from your perspective, is that overstating the case?
No, it's not overstating the case. I think that the Ukraine, they lost Crimea, and that hopefully is it. It will not go further. It can happen, but I'm hoping it's not happening. Unfortunately, the power of Putin is not very controlled by anything. It's just he doesn't care what the world thinks. He's just one of the new total absolutist rulers. The only big opposition inside of Russia might be the people who are very economically connected to the West, the oligarchs. That once you have a madman in the head, it's hard. It's uncontrolled power, which is the worst what can happen to any country in the world.
You're a chemist, and you know something about uncontrolled reactions. And
oh my God, yes.
What can sustain them, and what causes them to burn out? I mean, as you look around Europe, right around you, there are the remains of empires or nations that imagine themselves as an empire that are just skeletons, gone, you know, vanished. The Habsburgs, the Polish Empire from centuries ago, the Ottoman Empire that fell after World War I. Who's to say that Russia won't end up like that? And what will determine if, in fact, it goes the other direction, that Russia would restore its empire? As a chemist, what's going to keep this reaction going and what's going to cause it to burn out?
Well, actually, I think that the economy is very important part of it. Russia is not very dispersed economy. It's very one-way oriented. It's oriented to the export of the oil and gas. If they would realize that there is a power in being like a conglomerate and have a common market, and they would be able to really make it powerful economic union, that would probably be much different Europe.
Michael Level, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Michael Level is a chemist and a 63-year-old citizen of the Czech Republic. All of the people we have been speaking to from Central and Eastern Europe say the ghosts of history in the lands that lie between Germany and Russia are suddenly alive. In the past few weeks, Vladimir Putin speaking of Russian territorial rights, Germany trying to reassure Belarus, Latvia, and Estonia. This is both a chilling irony and a vivid memory of a brutal 20th century history. We turn now once again to Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Welcome back to the program, Professor.
Very glad to talk to you.
The history of Europe between Germany and Russia goes back really to the 1930s. It goes back farther than that, but the brutal history that you describe in your book really begins in that period between 1931 and 1945. Can you remind us of what happened in that territory between Russia and Germany?
There are a couple of things that are worth remembering. I mean, we in America look at all this from a great distance, and when we think about history, we use big concepts like Hitler or like appeasement. But from the point of view of the people who lived in independent states in Europe, in Eastern Europe or Central Europe, the 1930s were a period when independence and nation statehood were chipped away at and destroyed. So one line of analogies that comes to the mind of people in Austria or Germany or Lithuania and Poland would be the Anschluss of Austria by Germany in 1938, the destruction of Czechoslovakia by Germany, which began with the annexation by Germany of a little bit of territory called the Sudetenland. Then you move to the joint German-Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939, which a lot of Poles remember in this connection with Russia today, because the argument that the Soviet Union used to invade Poland in 1939 was that the Polish state no longer existed. That's the exact same argument which Russian leaders make now about Ukraine, that despite appearances, there is no longer a Ukrainian state. And then, of course, in 1940, the Soviet Union occupied the Baltic states, who didn't put up a fight. And that's an analogy which a lot of people are thinking about in the Baltic region as well. You know, should the Ukrainians be ready to go to war? And then there's a second element, a much deeper, darker element, which is that in a very broad way, the lands between the Soviet Union and Germany in the 1930s were the places of a huge colonial competition between Nazi Germany and the Stalinist Soviet Union, in which all in all, something like 14 million human beings were killed. And in that period between 1933 and 1945, the absolute worst place to be of all was Ukraine. Something like half of the people who were killed, maybe a bit more, were actually killed in Ukraine, first as a result of Soviet policy and then as a result of German policy.
And we're not talking about soldiers who died in the conflict. We're talking about civilians who were put to death either by the Nazis or by the Soviets.
It's a great point. Something like 3 million people in Soviet Ukraine were starved to death. We're talking about children, women, and men in 1932 and 1933. Another several hundred thousand were killed in the Great Terror in the Soviet Union. And then all that is before the invasion of the Soviet Union by Germany. And the invasion of the Soviet Union is, of course, not an invasion of Russia. It's an invasion of the Soviet Union. And the Western Soviet Union is precisely Belarus and Ukraine. So the worst of the war, the worst of the the German occupation was precisely in Ukraine. Another 5 or 6 million people are killed as a result.
Well, bearing in mind that brutal history and that level of killing that went on, can people listening to President Obama or the leaders of NATO saying, we will defend you, can they be reassured given the history that you've just described?
On the one hand, there is a deep existential fear, the fear that comes from a very recent history of having your state destroyed, which most of us would have difficulty understanding. At the same time, it's precisely that existential fear which leads to the very rational political desire to belong to the West or to belong to a military alliance which promises protection. So naturally, this is a moment when people in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, countries that have tasted Soviet aggression but are now members of NATO, are wanting further assurances, are wanting troop presences. And it's also naturally a time when Ukrainians, who are the ones who are under the most direct threat right now, obviously, since part of their country has been invaded by Russia and Russian troops are on their eastern border, want to have closer cooperation with the West. We can't resolve these fears, but of course, it's sound policy to take them into account.
So the fear that you describe may be something remote to a Barack Obama, but it's certainly not remote to a Vladimir Putin. Do you see him deliberately playing on these fears and pulling these levers in his political calculus?
Yes, exactly. In fact, he's using, it's a triangle. I mean, he's using Barack Obama to try to increase these fears at the moment so the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is speaking to the American Secretary of State, John Kerry, on a regular basis. And what this does, going over the heads of the Ukrainians or going over the heads of the East Europeans, is it revives the specter of some kind of diplomatic solution over the heads of the people involved, just like Munich and Czechoslovakia in 1938, or just like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact between Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939, when states were destroyed without the consent and indeed without even the voice of the people who were most directly concerned. Putin is perfectly aware that these kinds of discussions with America terrify East Europeans. And if you read the Russian press releases, they're edited in such a way as to maximize these fears. The Russians keep suggesting that the Americans are about to sell them out, which is not true. At least I hope it's not true. But the continuation of Russian-American discussions about questions that are fundamentally internal Ukrainian questions, I think, is designed on the Russian side to create the impression in Ukraine that they're about to be sold out and that their future doesn't really exist.
So John Kerry comes back to Washington and says, hey, we're still talking. And people in Ukraine look at that and say, here we go again.
Well, I don't know what Kerry is telling the people in Kyiv, right? I mean, he may be offering very sound reassurances to his colleagues there as well about what he's saying to Lavrov. I wouldn't want to speak to that. But certainly that is a concern in Ukraine. And it's a concern which the Russians are very consciously trying to maximize. They're trying to present the Ukrainians as having no friends. It should be said, however, that American policy on other fronts has been quite reassuring to Ukrainians, at least in the last few weeks.
Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale University, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk about the sleep habits of some very stressed out New Yorkers. How are you doing sleep-wise? From Osterville, Mass, trying to fit as much into my day as possible, work 9 to 5, fitness, food prep, like dinner, making lunch for the next day, doing stand-up at open mics, which could go to 1 a.m. depending on how many other performers are there, keeping up with bills and obligations, time can pass you by. Tweet us at thetakeaway.org if you're not too tired.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
And now, while you sleep, your body is restoring itself, right? Your mind is going over the stresses of the day and putting them in context. Brain cells injured get repaired. We dream, that is the case, in between our real dreams. I love that, real dreams. But it's all by way of saying that sleep is probably the world's most common mystery. Everybody sleeps, but what goes on when we sleep? Mystery. Our colleagues at WNYC are gearing up a big effort to solve that mystery, getting people to take data on themselves, observe their own sleep patterns, and compile a map of sleeping patterns all around the country. There's already some data out there. For instance, the tracking service Jawbone says New York City goes to bed on average 28 minutes later than the rest of the country. As part of the Clock Your Sleep project on WNYC, reporter Ilya Maritz took a trip downtown to experience sleep deprivation Wall Street style. Ilya, welcome.
Good to be here.
Did you get a good night's sleep last night?
I went to bed extra early because I knew I'd be coming in to talk to you, John.
That's right. So your task here as part of this big WNYC project is to give us a profile geographically of the sleep pattern, the sleep profile, the sleep health of New York City.
Yeah, and I chose an industry that is both secretive and has a lot of sleep problems, and that's Wall Street. I basically wanted to get a sense how people who work on trading desks or work in iBanking, arranging mergers, these high-pressure jobs, find out how they sleep. And I spent a lot of time with one young man in his 20s called Roden Monrose. Right after college, he went to a trading desk at Citigroup, worked there for 3.5 years. This is really fast-paced work. He got up every morning at 4:30, kept going with chai lattes and five-hour energy drinks.
So in many ways, he's sort of self-medicating sleep out of existence in his life on some level.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's how he put it.
5 hours, I would just have six packs in my drawer, and I'd just use it as needed throughout the day.
Wall Street trader Roden Monrose in the buildings downtown where the lights are on all night long, right?
Right. I mean, maybe it's not just negligence. Maybe people are working there.
So who else did you look at?
I wanted to get a bigger picture. I mean, Roden was able to tell me about his personal experience, but there's actually not a lot of literature out there about the lifestyle habits of Wall Streeters. There's one woman, though, who has had really a remarkably up-close look. Her name is Alexandra Michelle. She is a former Goldman Sachs investment banker. And about 13 years ago, she started studying a cohort of dozens of investment bankers at two banks who are unnamed. And she'll show up with them when they show up at work. She'll stay with them through their day. She'll leave when they leave. And over time, she got a really clear view of their attitudes about sleep.
The bankers often talked about how little they slept because that's a badge of honor. You never hear bankers bragging about how energized they felt after a good night of rest or after a leisurely weekend.
What she found that was really interesting is that you can kind of keep this up for the first 4 years of working really long days with not very much sleep. But at about year four, that starts to change. The stresses on the body just become unavoidable.
At year four, people start to experience physical breakdowns. Insomnia, chronic pain, endocrine disorders.
And in fact, Roden Monrose told me he witnessed this firsthand. Check this out.
I've seen a guy just destroy a computer keyboard. Just absolutely just smash it to bits after a mistake was made in a government bond auction for U.S. Treasuries. And there's another guy actually who, wow, he just had a full-out breakdown. So much so that he like needed to take time off too.
So this is the combination of little sleep and high stress.
Yeah, and there's a paradox here. This sort of fascinated me throughout my reporting because this is Wall Street, right? Like, this is the place where you calculate things to the fifth decimal point. It's very high stakes. It's also very profitable. So you might expect that traders would be treated like elite athletes, you know, get your sleep every night, get your nutrition. But in fact, it's a very different setup where after a few years, people start to fail, or at least their bodies start to fail. I put this to Alexandra Michelle, who's been studying these iBankers for over a dozen years, and she said, look, the individuals bear the cost here. The banks are constantly recruiting on college campuses. They have new blood coming in all the time, really talented people. So they, by and large, don't really suffer the consequences of this. It's the individuals who do.
Ilya Maritz is a reporter for WNYC Radio. To see more of WNYC's reporting on sleep and sign up to track your own sleep patterns and to see how they compare with everybody else's sleep patterns, you can head over to WNYC.org/sleep. The next two of our final four competition between TV greats now. We've already heard from Data from Star Trek TNG and Archie Bunker from All in the Family. Now an emblematic slam dunk scene from Mary Richards of The Mary Tyler Moore Show up against Lucy from I Love Lucy.
In order to illustrate why Mary Richards is the greatest television character of all time, I present the final episode of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, number 168. Mary and her colleagues in the newsroom are all being fired after a new news director has come to the station. It's not just goodbye for the viewers, it's goodbye for all of the characters. Each of them tries their best to keep their chins up, but Mary, who regularly showcases her vulnerabilities, is willing to do so one last time, to say out loud what the rest of her colleagues want to, but can't.
Well, I just wanted you to know that sometimes I get concerned about being a career woman. I get to thinking my job is too important to me. And I tell myself that the people I work with are just the people I work with and not my family. And last night I thought, what is a family anyway? They're just people who make you feel less alone and really loved. And that's what you've done for me. Thank you for being my family.
That's the final episode of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. The episode won an Emmy. It was ranked the third best TV finale of all time by TV Guide, and it was used as the template for the finale of Friends. And it showcases why Mary Richards is the greatest television character of all time.
You might just make it after.
I have the proud task of defending Lucy, played by Lucille Ball. In the first 1952 season of I Love Lucy, in an episode called Lucy Does a Commercial, she got a chance to tape a commercial for a health drink called Vitamita Vegemin, which contained, along with vitamins, a good deal of alcohol. In the show, she had to do a number of takes, sampling the stuff each time. And you can hear the result.
I don't know where to start unless I begin at the beginning.
All right, start at the beginning.
Oh, thank you. Hello, friends. I'm your Vitamita Vegemin girl. Are you tired, run down, listless? Do you poop out at parties? Are you unpopular? The answer to all your problems is in this little bottle. Little bottle. Vitamita Vegemin contains vitamins, meats, vegetables, and minerals. All you have to do is take a big tablespoonful after every meal. It's so tasty, too. Tastes like candy. Honest.
Let's take away Movie Date co-host Kristen Meinzer with her heroic defense of Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show up against me defending the obvious correct choice for best TV character of all time, Lucy of I Love Lucy. I mean, kind of a cheap shot taking that scene from the last episode of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, you know what I mean? But I can't vote on this. We have to be fair. No more selling from the host. It's up to you to vote. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to cast your vote or to nominate your own TV great this Friday when we select the top two finalists from our brackets. We will add a third contestant based on your comments. So go to our website. Let us know which character you think absolutely should be on this list. Again, you can find the whole competition at thetakeaway.org. You can also tell us about your sleep patterns, as we talked about earlier this hour. React to anything on the program. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.